This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, on May 18th, there was a talk by Palestinian activist Michelle Shehadeh, and there was an introduction by Kaylee, who shall remain nameless, and Ian from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. This is a good talk. There's a lot of rhetoric on both sides, both the Israeli and Palestinian side. He pretty much sticks to historical facts, which is why this is an important lecture. It's in the context of imperialism, which you don't hear very often. So, and that's where I'm coming from with this show. That's how I report on Israel-Palestine. I try and shy away from it, but in light of recent events, I've had to do much more on Israel and Palestine. I stayed away from the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, because, as you'll hear, he alludes to it in this lecture, the white supremacists are using this to this is what the Israelis have done. And so they endorsed the BDS movement, the white supremacists. And that's why it's important to separate real anti-Semitism from criticism of a regime that may have had good intentions, but went down the road to hell. And in my own personal opinion and my observations over life, boycotts and divestment is a very important, powerful tool that seems to work. And if you read the book, The Transfer Agreement by Edwin Black, there was an international boycott that would have stopped the Nazis, but Simon Wiesenthal was supporting that, but a small faction of Jews that wanted to start Israel for very noble reasons to save the Jews of Germany stopped an international boycott that most historians say would have brought the Nazis to their knees. For well-intentioned reasons that did not work very well at all. So boycott, divestment, and sanctions do work, and they are a good thing to use. Yeah, I've tried to keep it in the context of imperialism and colonialism. And that's what he does too. So I'm going to play you the most of the intros and most of the lecture this week, and then I'll play you the second half and play the Q&A afterwards, because it's about an hour and a half worth of material. So I'll play you the second half next week. At all times, as usual, please use your own brain and, read a book once in a while. Not that you don't. It's important to read entire books, not just pick up snippets of information. You have to, books tend to put it in context, magazines a little bit, but books much more so than the sound bites that you get on the news. So please use your own brain at all times when listening to Talk Is Cheap and KEPW and any type of media, and please support independent media where you're going to get some alternatives that you wouldn't hear otherwise. So coming up, Michelle Shehadeh. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
To this conversation and discussion with Michelle Shehadeh, co-hosted by PSL and JVP Eugene. I know that many of us here today have been involved in some capacity with organizing, attending, and participating in the Movement for Palestinian Liberation, both before and in the months following October of last year. The current movement for a free Palestine is arguably at its highest profile ever.
Yeah.
Woo! With marches and actions involving millions of people all around the world. Our very own University of Oregon students have joined the growing number of encampments dedicated to demanding divestment from and condemnation of Israel's genocidal campaign against Palestine. outside the campus, many community members and various groups have organized events and actions and also put pressure on our local city government to join in the global movement for divestment as well. The people and the students of Eugene have made it our voice crystal clear that we will not be complicit in genocide. Yeah. However, the movement for a free Palestine, as many of you likely know, did not begin on October 7th, 2023. It has been a 75, 76, even longer, year-long struggle to free the people of Palestine from colonial subjugation and domination. Our guest today is a veteran of this movement, having faced persecution at the hands of the American state for speaking out and organizing against the oppression of Palestinians in an era where doing so was definitely not as mainstream as it is today. Michelle Shahada and the rest of the Los Angeles Eight, as they're called, were arrested, jailed, charged with felonies, and threatened with deportation because in 1987, they were leading the pro-Palestine movement in the Los Angeles area. As a result of an anti-communist Zionist witch hunt, Michelle and his fellow activists were engulfed in a decades-long legal battle against the American government. The state of California repeatedly attempted to charge the LA8 with a laundry list of fraudulent crimes, which were officially thrown out by judges again and again for lack of evidence. And the case of the LA8 was eventually completely dropped in 2007 after 20 years of attempted prosecution. The story of the LA8 shows us that the struggle for Palestinian liberation has always been seen by the United States Empire as a fundamental threat to its interests. And it is important to look to the past to help inform us as a movement on how to continue forward. It is events just like this that Palestinian civil society has called for here in the United States to raise awareness about the genocidal oppression and mass slaughter, which our tax dollars go towards funding and maintaining. So I'm very excited to introduce our program for tonight. Today's program is going to begin with some brief introductions about each of the co-sponsors of this event, Jewish Voice for Peace and Party for Socialism and Liberation. And as well as some information about how you can get involved with those various organizations, for each of those organizations. Afterwards, Michelle is going to give a presentation, followed by a question and answer period, which I will moderate. Feel free to get up and use the bathroom, enjoy the refreshments we have here. I'd like to invite Ian to come and talk to us a little bit about the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Join me in welcoming Ian.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ian. I'm a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. In a couple of months, the PSL turns 20 years old. In 2004, we started with a handful of communists who were determined to build a large-scale socialist party in a country that seemed to have most thoroughly rejected socialism. Since then, the PSL has grown tremendously. Today, we are active in hundreds of U.S. cities and towns. Many dedicated committed revolutionaries, including many from oppressed communities, have joined our ranks. But we do not intend to grow in numbers at any cost. We do not sacrifice our principles for the sake of expediency. Quite often, this is meant being subjected to relentless demonization campaigns, not just by the capitalist ruling class, but also by the liberal wing of the progressive movement. The PSL is proud to stand with Cuba and Venezuela in the face of intense imperialist attempts at counter-revolution. The PSL is also proud to stand against the demonization campaigns targeting China, the DPRK, Iran, Syria, and Yemen. You will never find the PSL siding with the so-called pro-democracy movements that U.S. imperialism is funding. The very nature of imperialism requires it to fight independent states and movements and promote right-wing capitalist forces all around the globe. The PSL has provided in-depth analysis on each of the U.S. foreign policy strategies and countries targeted for overthrow. But the main principle that guides us is the right of oppressed nations to self-determination. Our task here is to struggle against the head of world imperialism and its interventions around the globe. I want to say a few words about what has become the central point of the progressive movement worldwide, Palestine. During the large anti-war marches and rallies against the U.S. occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, the liberal wing of the anti-war movement insisted on excluding Palestine. The issue of Palestine is divisive, they would say. What does Iraq have to do with Palestine? Let's just keep our unity by focusing only on Iraq. The PSL and the Answer Coalition, which the PSL led, refused to go along with this opportunistic approach. While pro-Palestine activists like Michelle Shehadeh had to fight to speak on behalf of the Palestinian struggle in every rally at every forum, we made sure that the Palestinian struggle was represented. In every major city, there were intense debates among activists. Liberal forces mocked us for publicizing a laundry list of issues at rallies. The PSL is proud to have stood on the side of Palestine at a time a few others would. And no, the voice of the Palestinian struggle was never silenced. The liberals did not want publicity given to the ongoing crimes of Israel. When they had to, they would condemn the occupation, by which they meant the vast lands Israel occupied in the 1967 Six-Day War. But they emphasized Israel's right to exist as a state. Well, May 15, just 3 days ago, was the 76th anniversary of Al-Nakba. Israel did not change its character in 1967. The State of Israel, from its founding, was a colonial settler project. The Al-Nakba was a catastrophe because it was a violation of the right of the Palestinian people to their land, their freedom, and to their very existence. There's nothing legitimate about the State of Israel. A colonial settler state has no right to exist. And the PSL has never been afraid to state this. The negation of the genocidal state of Israel obviously does not mean the Jewish people now living in occupied Palestine have no right to exist. What it does mean is that the racist, exclusivist Israeli state has to end. Today, thanks to the heroic resistance of the Palestinian people, and the horrendous level of Israeli genocide, few U.S. progressives talk about 1967 as the start of Israel's crimes. Similarly, few U.S. progressives are today condemning Palestinians for resisting the Israeli state by any means necessary. We don't often hear people demanding that Palestinians condemn violence while bombs are raining down on them, while their children are being massacred. The PSL is proud to have been an active participant on the right side of the struggle. We will never place conditions on states and forces resisting oppression. The PSL now has several active members in Eugene. If you're interested in learning more about the PSL, or if you are considering joining us in the fight against imperialism and the struggle for socialism, please ask me or one of our activists at the literature table down there. Our 2024 presidential campaign can also be found at VoteSocialist2024.com. Make sure to follow our two incredible candidates, Claudia De La Cruz and Karina Garcia, on social media. And finally, long live Palestine.
Thank you so much, Ian. Now I'd like to ask you to join me in welcoming Laura from Jewish Voice for Peace Eugene to talk a little bit about GVP.
Hi, my name is Laura Diamond, and I'm here with Jewish Voice for Peace, who is co-sponsoring this event with PSL. And I'll keep it short so we can get to our guest of honor, who I know you're here to hear. JVP Eugene is here today to lift up Palestinian voices and to learn from rich histories of resistance to repression like that of Michelle Shehadeh and the Los Angeles 8. Personally, I am here co-organizing this event because for as long as I can remember, I have seen a state that was supposedly created for the benefit of my people steal and ravage Palestinian land, murder, imprison, and systemically oppress Palestinian people, and silence those who reject that with accusations of anti-Semitism and mentions of the Holocaust. The hypocrisy of the situation is cruel and devastating. So it is our job as Jews to do everything in our power to negate this narrative. Jewish Voice for Peace is a Jewish-led anti-occupation and anti-Zionist organization that was founded in 1996 and has transformed over the years as more Jews came to understand our role in upholding Jewish values by denouncing Zionism and fighting for Palestinian liberation. In an age where anti-Semitism is weaponized to prevent anyone from criticizing the actions of the Israeli state, we believe it's important to present another Jewish voice, one that stands firmly against colonization, occupation, and genocide. One that says never again means never again to anyone.
That's right.
JVP works with Palestinian organizations in Palestine and the U.S. to develop our strategy for doing this work. JVP National works on a few fronts: direct action, political education, and congressional advocacy. JVP Eugene formed when local Jews came together in November to respond to the ongoing and escalating genocide in Palestine. We have all been in collaboration with JVP National as well as other local organizing groups to take action in response to calls from Palestine and locally. We have lobbied Val Hoyle's office, sponsored rallies, organized educational events like this one, and supported students in the UO encampment, to name a few things. And moving forward, we will continue to evolve with these calls and expand JVP community. We hope from this event that you will feel more informed in the action that you are taking and inspired to learn more. There are several ways you can get involved and be in solidarity, and we encourage you to find the places where you fit best and can contribute. If you're interested in the work that our organization is doing, you can find our materials at the back on that table over there, and can sign up to our mailing list. We also have a Signal thread. If you're interested, please find us afterwards. Many of us are wearing these t-shirts. And speaking of the t-shirts, if you're interested in buying one, $10 of every t-shirt sold goes to the Palestinian Children's Fund. And if you're interested, just put your email address, your t-shirt size, and indicate that you'd like a t-shirt on our mailing list sign up, and Shakar will reach out to you in the next week or so. Please enjoy and take advantage of this opportunity to hear from Michelle. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. I've been so impressed with the work of JVP Eugene as a local organizer and just such a critical ally in the work that we're doing. Now for the big event.
thank you, Ian and Laura. Please join me in welcoming Michelle Shabbat.
Good evening. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you, comrades, sisters, brothers. I like to begin by thanking the organizers, PSL and JVP, for inviting me here to talk to you and discuss with you and have a conversation about a noble cause, the liberation of Palestine. And why is this an important issue for us to talk about? Forget, you know, what's happening in the streets, forget about the students in the student encampments, forget about the demonstrations, the fights in Gaza and all of that, but for 1 minute, think about it this way. Palestinian colonization is the last colonization in history. It's the last direct colonization in history. And when Palestine is liberated, meaning direct colonization is out of history, never again. What does that mean? That means a new era, a new dawn is coming into this world. That's why liberating Palestine is so important for humanity, for all of us, for the world, for the future, for the next generation, for everyone that wants a better world. That's why the Palestinian liberation. The Palestinian people and Palestine, the land, is important to be free, because there is no separation. The land and its people are one cause.
Yes. That's
anyway, they asked me to talk a little bit about my credentials here, about the case. And as much as I love to talk about the case, because what's happening today in campuses, what's happening today in the streets, it's a deja vu for me. It feels like I lived this moment before. Not on this scale, but it's a representation of what's happening to today. Yesterday was an accumulation, was a preparation, was a trial, maybe, for what's going on today. Because it's the same issues on campuses and on the streets. You remember that the case happened in 1987, in January, but also in December of that year, that was the first Intifada. And we had all the same kind of mechanism, the same kind of dynamics happening as what's happening today, although on a smaller scale. But it was important, because without that, we wouldn't have today. I mean, Gaza is important, but the first Intifada was important. The invasion of Lebanon in 1982 was important. Everything that happened with Palestine is important, because they are not separate events. What happened in Palestine is a discourse, and people keep saying, you know, October 7th was not the beginning of things, but it is a Nakba day in 1948-76, and I like to correct them. The Zionist colonial project, which started it all, was in 1897 in Basel, Switzerland. That's the beginning of the modern Zionist movement, because I always say to people that Zionism is before this new Zionist movement. Christian Zionism was before the Zionist movement, today's Zionist movement that started with Herzl. All of the thinking, all of what happened before was preparation for this. Colonialism started a long time ago. Even it can go back to the Crusaders' time when they occupied Palestine. You go look at the literature. You'll be surprised when you find concepts, language, that had just came to us from that time to here. A lot of the racism, a lot of the hate that we see today also we inherited from that time. But in 1897, what triggered the modern Zionist movement is the pogroms in Russia, and the direct event that inspired Theodor Herzl to write his book, The Jewish State, which became the unofficial manifesto of the Zionist movement, was triggered by the Dreyfus incident, which was a Jewish colonel in the French army who was accused of betraying the French army. But why? Because the right wing in France wanted to use this case to take control of the army from the liberal forces in France. And the conclusion, there was a big political fight, so some supporting the charges, and a lot of people were against the charges. There was a big political fight. What Herzl came to a conclusion instead of joining the fight against what's going on, he came to a conclusion that anti-Semitism is an inherent character of the human being, that it's in the human being's DNA, you cannot take it out. So the only way you can find a solution to the Jewish question, quote unquote, is to get all the Jews out and put them in a state of their own. That was his premise. That's why he never really joined the fight for Jewish rights in Europe. And what's telling is when the pogroms in Kishinev, especially against the Jews, where 46 Jews were killed and 86 people were wounded and crippled, that was instigated and inflamed by the Tsar Nicholas III in Russia. And why? Because the feudal system in Russia was decaying. The peasants and the working class in Russia were rising up. They wanted a democracy. They wanted their rights. So how the Nicholas III and his apparatus thought of diverting this energy from being directed at them, they thought of a scheme of let us use the decade long of anti-Semitism and direct this energy towards the Jews of Russia. And that's what happened. But when the first Zionist conference happened in Basel, Switzerland, Herzl was given the assignment of finding an imperial backer of the Zionist movement. So he did. You know, he went and saw the Sultan of Turkey. He went and saw the Pope. But again, he went to Russia and made a deal with Wenzel von Pilev, the interior minister of Russia, who orchestrated the pogroms personally. He went there and met with Pilev and had an agreement with him. And that agreement is that if you help us, because they agreed on one thing together, that Jews doesn't belong in Russia, or did not belong in Russia. That's what they agreed on. So he made an agreement with him saying, if you help us get all the Jews to go to Palestine, we will not mention anything about your treatment of Jews in our next conference. And that's what happened. Go back to the history. Go look at what's been written, and people have written books. All the documents are there. The conference never mentioned anything about the pogroms or the Russian repression of Jews and killing of Jews. This Zionist movement behavior have been consistent all through history. I can give you another example of how the Zionists dealt with Nazism. There is a good book for you to read by Leni Brenner. It's called Zionism in the Age of Dictators. That documents every detail about the deals that the Zionist movement had with the Nazis. And in a nutshell, they agreed that the Zionists asked the Nazis if they would let the young people go to Palestine, it's okay if the older people got killed. So the deal is, don't kill the young people. We want them to go to Palestine, and this way you get rid of them, and it's okay if you don't let the older ones leave. That's a consistent way of the Zionist movement behavior and attitude when it came to dealing with the Jewish question, because they believed that they don't want to be a part of the fight for the civil rights, the human rights of Jews in their own countries. They wanted them to go to Palestine. That's, in a nutshell, what I can tell you about Zionism. There is a lot of books to look into this and expand your knowledge about how it all started. It started as an imperial colonizing project. The relationship, the writings, and the correspondence between Herzl and Cecil Rhodes, for example, is all there. When Herzl was talking to Cecil Rhodes, Cecil Rhodes is the guy who was the British guy who was responsible for the colonization of Africa. And he told them, Herzl told Cecil Rhodes, why should you care about the Zionist movement? Because it is a colonial project. And you need us, and in other writings he told us, you need us as being the guard, the vanguard of protecting your interests in the Arab world and be the guard of the Suez Canal. And that's what the British wanted. They wanted a client place, a client state in that region to protect its own interests. Why then, if you think about it, why then the Sykes-Picot agreement between France and England, which was the agreement to divide the Arab world from being one world, one chunk of country, into 22 countries. And in the middle of that, they created Israel, the Zionist entity that needed to be a base, a military base, the vanguard for imperialism, for the British Empire, to keep that world divided so the empire can siphon the fortunes of that land and keep it divided, fighting each other under control. And of course, after the United States took that role of being the empire, it continued to do the same thing. That's why in 1917, the Balfour Declaration came out by Britain that gave the land of Palestine, a land they did not own, a land that they did not control, because the mandate of Palestine was given to Britain in 1922. But the Balfour Declaration was in 1917. So they were giving this land to the Zionists, well, as I mentioned, a land that they didn't own or control, to a movement, to the Zionists, who did not live there. That was the Balfour Declaration, which stated that they wanna, the government of His Majesty, the King, would do everything they can to create a home, a national home for the Jews. I mean, Herzl wrote about this and he said, don't worry about the word home, everybody will understand it's going to be a state. And that what they've been working on. So when the British came, took the mandate of Palestine, all what they were doing is helping the Zionist movement build the infrastructure and prepare Palestine to be given as a state to the Zionists. In 1936, I mean, the Palestinians have resisted. It's not like they sat back and just watched what happened. A lot of people ask why in 1948 the Palestinians did not fight harder than they fought, why they lost it so easily. The reason is Britain made sure that the Palestinian society was exhausted from 1929, where the big intifada happened, with the big rebellion happened, they call it Al-Burak Rebellion, 1929. The British cracked down and they didn't leave any activist, any Palestinian who spoke against the Zionist or against the British mandate, either killed them or put them in jail. In 1936, the biggest rebellion, the biggest Palestinian rebellion, and they did a strike which considered the longest strike in history for 3 years. The British have cracked down on Palestinian society. They had 5,000 activists in jail. They killed at least 15,000 of the elites, of the leaders of the Palestinians. By the time we got to 1948, Palestinians were exhausted completely. Their resources, human resources, everything. But they fought back. They didn't sit down, they fought back. And Abdel Qader al-Husseini, who was killed in one of the battles, who was the leader of the Palestinian resistance then. And the Arab regimes, of course, the story of the Zionists, that all the Arab regimes, all the Arab armies had attacked us. That was seriously a play. The Arab regimes were either the Egypt kingdom, or they did not like the Palestinian at all, because they were afraid, you know, at their regimes. They betrayed them. The history says that Abdel Qader, which was the leader of the Palestinian resistance, had gone to the Arab governments and asked for weapons so they can fight the Zionists and resist, and nobody wanted to give him any weapons. So he went back and fought and died. That's the truth of history. Now in 1948, the seismic event of Al-Nakba, the catastrophe, happened. And that defined the region, that defined the Middle East completely, and I dare saying that it defined the world, because look at Gaza right now, look at Palestine right now, it's in every government office, it's in every street, it's in every campus. So that event defined what comes after it in the region. 700 to 800,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed, out of a million. Out of a million, so 100,000, between 100,000 to 150,000 stayed behind. 500 villages and towns were erased from the map, completely erased. Those refugees, those people who were Palestinians, who were ethnically cleansed, they became refugees, and they are still refugees to this moment, living in wretched camps. 80% of the people of Gaza, 80% of the people of Gaza are refugees from that event, the Nakba event that happened in 1948. This is like a third, fourth, fifth generation are being in Gaza, fighting not just for Gaza, for Palestine, but fighting to go back for the right of return. So if you want to know what's in the core of the, what is the core of the Palestinian problem, it is the right of return. Without that, there is no resolution or liberation for Palestine. Those refugees need to be returned. And the Zionists have always said, and the attitude of them always said, that the old, meaning the Palestinians, the old will die and the young will forget. But let's look now. Yes, the old died, but the young did not forget. They tell it, the stories of their grandparents. They, the amazing things is that you go and you get a kid in the refugee camp and ask him, where are you from? He'll tell you he's from that village in Palestine. He'll tell you about the alleys where his or her house were located. They tell you about the fig tree, and the mulberry tree, or the lemon tree, or the orange, where they're located. They carried the geography of Palestine, although it changed, but they carried it in their hearts and in their beings. And those kids who are fighting right now in Gaza, in the West Bank, and in the 1948 area, because people tend to forget that there is the West Bank also because of what's happening in Gaza and the extent of the pain and suffering and killing and the genocide in Gaza. They forget about the West Bank. 400 people have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th. Nobody talks about it. But the plan of repeating a Nakba is happening, because a Nakba was not a one-time event. It never stopped. So when they tell you that what's happening in Palestine started on October 7th, no. It started in 1897, and a Nakba just was a defining event, is where started the tragedy more and more, the question of the refugees and the suffering of the refugees. It never stopped. It has been going on every day. The killing, the ethnic cleansing, the destruction of homes, the uprooting of trees, it's been happening. I lived it before I came to the state. In 1975, I lived it. I saw the killing, I saw the humiliation, I saw the occupation, and I cannot tell you how much a human being can carry this pain inside and be able to survive, but we survive. That's why when I started telling the story about the Palestinian people, about my own experience when I came to the state, what did the government want to do? They wanted to silence the pro-Palestinian talk. They wanted me and my colleagues and my comrades to not be able to speak. Exactly what they're doing today. This time, it's not the Palestinians. This time, they want to stop the Americans who are pro-Palestinians from not speaking. And what they do, they accuse them of being anti-Semitic. Like they accused us of being quote-unquote communist. Why? Because they used a 1952 law, McCarthy era law, called the McCarran-Walter Act. And you know what was the accusation? It would make you laugh now. They said that we are affiliates or belong to an organization that distributed literature that advocated the doctrines of world communism. That's not us who were advocating. We were distributing literature, and that literature is what advocated world communism, meaning any one of you here can be accused under that law. Because now if you got this flyer and you distribute it, you can be charged under that law. That case represented first the Palestinian right to speak their narrative. It represented the right of immigrants to be able to speak about their issues. And who's better to speak about their issues than the immigrants about their countries, especially those countries where U.S. intervention has impacted those countries or made those countries suffer. They should be encouraged to speak. Third is your civil rights. Americans were being forbidden to listen to those people. It's your right as an American to listen to those immigrants. Taking away the immigrants' right to speak is taking away the rights of citizens to hear them, to hear their story, to be able to make a decision, an educated decision about foreign policy. But the U.S. government don't want you to be able to make educated decisions about their foreign policy. They wanted you to follow their line and just nod whenever they tell you to do. Send your kids, your daughters to go die somewhere else, quote unquote, to defend democracy and to defend the human rights in the world. And you know that's a lie. Because at the time when they're attacking Iran right now, which has a democracy, it has all the institutions of democracy, they're being cozy friends with the Saudi Arabians, who has no democracy at all. So the idea of defending the democracy and human rights in the world is a big lie, and you know that. But I'm just saying to confirm that it's got nothing to do about rights. It's everything to do with imperial interest. And let me give you a special hint about that. Biden, he always repeated that he's a Zionist. He always repeats that if Israel did not exist, we have to go out and invent it to be able to protect our interest in that region. Get the quote, that's what he says. So it's not about defending Jews or about the only democracy in the world, but it's about imperial interest. And with this comes all the fallacies that we hear about Zionism. You know, these fallacies, and I wrote a couple of notes here. These fallacies, I'm going to mention some of them because Ilan Pappe, he is an Israeli activist, wrote a book about this called The 10 Fallacies of Israel, Zionism. You know, I recommend that book to be read. But I wanted to mention some of them. Zionism is Judaism. This is what the Zionists want you to believe, wants us all to believe. That every Jew is a Zionist. And every Zionist is a Jew. A big lie. JVP will tell you it's a big lie. Yeah. The JVP is being accused of being anti-Semite. I mean, Palestinians are Semites also, but again, the term became, you know, Jew-hating. But the narrative, this narrative have now has been uncovered that Zionism is a political ideology. Zionism is a political movement. Judaism is a religion. And it's much broader than what they're trying to do. Because by reducing Judaism to be Zionist, they're not really helping the Jews. They're hurting them. And when they use the accusation of anti-Semitism about anybody who wants to speak about Palestinian rights or about what Israel is doing, like I'm doing. If I speak about my history, I'm accused of being an anti-Semitic. Again, I don't want to undermine how important the issue of anti-Semitism is, but it should be used against the real enemy of the Jews, the right-wing movements in the United States. Those are the people who are anti-Semites. And by using it as a pawn in a political game to restrict the rights of the pro-Palestinian voice who have a right to say that, to have, you know, not just a right, but they're speaking about their own issues, they're undermining this. Because now it rings hollow. If you just keep everybody speaks about Israel, you accuse him of being an anti-Semite, then anti-Semitism become ineffective. When you really want to use it in the right way, in the right manner, against Jew haters, against the Jews, the haters of the Jews, it loses its effect. You know what the German Nazis, racists right now are saying in Germany? We told you about those Jews. We told you how they behave, and talking about the Zionists. So combining this, Judaism and Zionism together, is hurting the Jews much more than anything else. It's really putting the Jews in harm's way.
Dark and gray, an English filmed Wednesday play. We always watch the Queen on Christmas Day. Won't you stay? Shipwrecked sailors, you're still dry. The outlook's fine, the whales might have some rain saved again. Still surprised, you wander the west in time to be our guest. Name your prize. Drop of wine, a glass of beer, dear, what's the time? The grime on the time is mine, oh mine, oh mine. 9:05. Blood on the rooftops, Venice in the spring. Streets of San Francisco, a word from Peking. The trouble was started by a young aeroplane. Better in my day, oh Lord. For when we got born, we'd have a world war, happy but poor. So let's give the news, boy, I'll go make that tea. Love on the rooftop.